You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative talents at one of the world's great opera companies. For additional podcast interviews, subscribe to our RSS feed or visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Lyric Opera Chorus Master Donald Nally is backstage at Lyric.
So when one would initially think that the chorus is often supposed to give us clues and cues about how we're supposed to react to the drama, in Bizet, it actually is often reversed, and we don't want to react the way in which the crowd is reacting, because the crowd has a somewhat disengaged attitude personally.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. In this episode, I have the pleasure of speaking to Donald Nally, Lyric's brilliant chorus master. He'll be giving us the inside story on preparing the first three productions he's working on this season: Massenet's Manon, Bizet's The Pearl Fishers, and the Lyric premiere of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Let's go to the interview. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, Donald, and welcome to your first podcast of Lyric Opera.
It's a pleasure to be here, Roger.
We need to talk about a couple of operas today, and also about what you're feeling in your second season as chorus master at Lyric. Well, first of all, The Pearl Fishers of Bizet, which you're in the middle of at this moment. Doesn't the chorus have a great deal to sing in
this
piece?
We're massive. because we have each of the acts has us in a major scene with a major sing.
Is there a fair amount of musical variety to what they have to do?
Yeah. In Acts 2 and 3, both of those are kind of kill 'em kind of choruses. And so they're very, very large, and they're very fast moving, this kind of way in which Bizet is trying to capture this combination of a dance and a primal, you know, kind of native dance.
Well, we should probably talk about who they're actually playing.
Well, they play these essentially Celanese, basic people who follow what would amount essentially to voodoo. And so they are very easily swayed by this or that. You know, the thunder scares them and they believe it's a sign from the god, and everything's a sign from the gods. And so they react very strongly when their princess, who is supposed to sing to keep the evil spirits away, is found out to not be keeping her pledge, her vow, to not only not interact with men, but also to stay veiled all the time, something that she has not been very successful at doing since an old boyfriend came to town. So she, at any rate, they discover that, and the answer is, of course, for them to kill her, to avenge the gods, but it is our hero who steps in and saves their lives. But this provides the chorus with ample opportunity to sing these fantastically large choruses, first asking for the death of these two lovers, and then second to call out to the gods in this amazing hymn, which is my favorite thing in the opera that they sing, is this great hymn to Brahma.
It's worthy of Aida, isn't it?
It's worthy of Aida. In fact, you can hear a little bit of that idea in there, you know, this massive him coming off the stage.
Now, it starts out pretty lively, doesn't it? They're doing a fun dance.
Yeah, we do a dance. Well, as I said, the chorus does, they're either dancing or praying, you know? And so the choruses have this fast-moving kind of, you know, whipped-up sound. Most of them are in 3-4, and they've got this triplet kind of feeling to them. So the opening is a little dance that is broken up by these pearl fishers singing about going out to sea, and then they elect a leader. And between each of those little sort of mini scenes, they go back to the dance music, and it gets louder and louder and bigger and bigger. So.
Now, we should remind everybody who's listening that this is the same composer that wrote Carmen, but is there anything that the chorus does that reminds you in any way of what people might hear in Carmen?
Yes, in terms of the fact that Bizet obviously really intended to use the chorus in both Carmen and in Pearl Fishers to offset this very personal drama. In both of them, they appear as a one kind of large character that is quite black and white and doesn't have the emotional depth as a group that the individuals have, which is why we get this great moment with, you know, Nathan Gunn comes in and he as a person is able to be more forgiving.
Playing the character of Zorga.
Zorga, yes. And to have more depth to him. And that is essentially the same thing in Carmen, where the chorus is, you know, in one scene they're like, you know, screaming about freedom, and another one they're just out smoking cigarettes and all this kind of stuff. But there's this other drama going on that is much more personal, much more like the individuals in the audience. So when one would initially think that the chorus is often supposed to give us clues and cues about how we're supposed to react to the drama, in Bizet, it actually is often reversed, and we don't want to react the way in which the crowd is reacting, because the crowd has a somewhat disengaged attitude personally, because, well, crowds are like that, if you haven't noticed. So, they don't actually give us our cues the way that they often do in Verdi. If you think about Traviata, and they're, you know, they become impassioned and sympathetic and et cetera.
What's the most beautiful thing that they sing in the course of the opera? Is it the prayer in Act 2?
I think it's it's repeated. It's the end of Act 1. It's repeated in Act 2. And, yeah, I have to say that, you know, there's this incredibly beautiful line in the middle of that prayer. The prayer is in three large chunks of 8 measures each, and the first is just this, you know, Brahma, Diva Brahma, you know, this huge outpouring, and then they kind of suddenly are forced into or snapped into this huge atmosphere of supplication and humility, and so it goes to this very piano moment, and it's got all these suspensions in the music, and they're really, really beautiful, and then it comes back up to end it with this enormous force again.
You know, most people, if they've heard anything from the piece, they've heard the tenor-baritone duet. And I think there are a lot of people out there who think that that's really all there is musically to this piece, and yet there's so much more in it.
Yes. A lot of people do. In fact, I listen to that tenor aria in the first act, and I just think, wow, it's amazing that you don't hear this more often, because it's such a beautiful aria. It is interesting that duet happens very early on in the opera, and you kind of like, and you keep hearing that theme for the rest of the night, but you never get the duet back, actually, you know. And so, and as a result of that, it keeps rolling out all this new music. I mean, the man was a real dramatist, and he knew how to build a scene up and to whip it up, really. So we talked about the hymn earlier, but we haven't talked about some of the processionals. You know, it's a story about people who, in some ways, live a very simple life, and their lives are about, you know, worshiping the gods, praying that they'll have, you know, a good pearl season. That's how it opens, is that we're praying that we'll go and find lots of good pearls. And so there's a lot of processing and worshiping, in that, you know, there's the second act set is this temple, and the first act set is a statue of a god, you know. And so, at any rate, it gives us, again, a lot of opportunity. All, of course, processionals are choral music, and it gives you that opportunity to make these variations. So you asked me earlier about all kinds of different kinds of music. Well, one of the biggest changes is the procession that happens when they first bring Leila in, this maiden who is about to become the priestess and pledge that she'll keep herself veiled forever. And it's such a beautiful little chorus that has this bloom, 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 and this kind of almost strangely frivolous tune. And then the chorus sings, what, just the sopranos, and then just the baritones, and then just the tenors, and then everybody comes together. And it's so clever. You sit there and go, it's such a simple idea, but it takes Bizet to make it work. And so I would say that, you know, there's a good 2.5 hours of other music that is worth hearing.
Now, we've got two French operas in a row.
We do.
Is French a language that the chorus enjoys, or do they consider it rather challenging to get it right?
You know, it's a good question. I'm not sure I know from their point of view exactly
I know that soloists have lamented on any number of occasions how difficult it is to sing French well.
See, I love working in French because it's so incredibly specific. And the sounds, you know, they're very different than the sounds that we make, and the way in which the French people speak is higher in the head, and it sounds a little nasal to people, you know, to the uninitiated. And, you know, they actually keep a much smaller space between the lips when they're speaking, and so all of that affects the sound of the language in a great way. And what's great about the singing in French is that all of those things are wonderful for vocal placement. At least for chorus, they're fantastic for choral placement because they bring the sound really forward, bright, and gets over the orchestra, and it's easier to tune that way instead of singing like in a dark sound, a Russian kind of sound. So I love working in it, and I have to say that the chorus they haven't seemed to struggle with it at all. You know, they seem to have really taken it on board and dived into this, especially Manon, which none of them really knew.
Now, as far as Manon goes, what sort of singing are they doing there? Is it radically different from what they're doing in Proficience?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
These operas are separated by about 20 years. So how is their singing in Manon different from the Proficience?
Yeah, well, in Manon, they're not put there to provide these large, huge chorus scenes, really. They are a part of a larger scene. So the first thing that they do in Manon is it's really exciting and huge when the carriage comes in and they're sort of making fun of everybody and all this kind of stuff. But it lasts probably 3 minutes. And, you know, it's not substantial. And it kind of is all much more a part of a line. Bizet was really doing ideas of a number opera where you have an aria and then you have a chorus and then you have an aria and then you have a chorus. And you may not be that aware of that when you're listening to it, but that's the structure of it. And Massenet was not doing that, and he was in terms thinking more scenes. So we don't have – there's never a moment where we have a great big prayer chorus or a great big dance chorus in Manon.
But there are opportunities everywhere, I think, for them to have a lot of fun on the stage.
Oh, it's great. What are they
doing on stage?
What's so wonderful about this production is, you know, in modern productions, we have the issue of how to afford to have a really large chorus when it's called for, when that chorus is often split up into various factions. And so, for example, in the very first scene of Manon, there is a whole faction of aristocrats who are arriving on this coach, and then there's all the people who wait on them and all the kind of like regular, normal peasants and things that are milling about. And in our production, those are turned into essentially aristocrats and artisans, because it's actually very timely. It's set in period, and so it works really, really well. But when you take the chorus and you split it in half like that, you immediately, you know, have the volume impact at any time, and so you have to figure out what to do. Well, David's production solves that problem immediately because a lot of the chorus goes back and forth between being spectators of this drama that is being played out literally on the stage in front of them as they sit in what look like theater bleachers, which are upstage. And so we're watching them watching this drama, and they kind of come in going, we don't really know what we're coming here for, but it's some sort of theater and we're excited about it. So every new character that's introduced, they get very excited because they're going like, well, who is this person and what are they going to do? And then they begin to have opinions about the people and who's a good person and who's a bad person. It's really, really fun. But it also allows them to sing everything, you know, so we can keep the numbers up all the time. So it's a brilliant, brilliant solution to a problem that we always have in opera.
Now, very soon, we're going to be starting in rehearsals for Porgy and Bess of George Gershwin. Now, we can't use our regular chorus for Porgy and Bess, correct?
Correct.
Can you explain why that is?
Well, because the Gershwin Estate requires that we have that we use an African-American chorus and cast, and which, you know, obviously makes sense because the story wouldn't really make sense otherwise. So we have only two African-Americans who sing in our chorus, and of course they'll be in the chorus of Porgy and Bess. But we had to go out and find 48 others.
And what was that experience like, and where did you go?
Well, we did quite a number of days here in Chicago, and then made the decision that we need to go to New York, where it's not just New York singers, but it's a more centralized situation. So I, you know, we have a lot of people from Philadelphia who had just recently done Porgy and Bess, Washington who has just recently done Porgy and Bess, and so they came and auditioned as well. But I mean, people came from Dallas. There's somebody in New York came from LA, so they came from all over because you know there's a lot of different productions touring. Productions of Porgy and Bess. In fact, one of our chorus members spent the summer playing Mariah in a touring company in Europe. So they're out there all over the place. And if we and if you're willing to put the investment into it and really make a commitment that you're going to seek the best chorus you can find it.
Now, how would you describe their role in Porgy and Bess? Oh, I mean, they have so much to do.
It's so great. It's, I mean, it's just, you know, I've done it once before, and it was one of the great experiences of my theater life because you just become so engaged by the music. You can't help it. The music is just so captivating. And so when, even in rehearsals, it's sometimes hard to, because I was just up, actually, I was upstairs earlier today, and I was thinking about we start next Wednesday, and what am I going to do in the first rehearsal and the second rehearsal, and how to pace it out so that we get it done in the week and a half I have to just teach the music. And I'm looking at the music and I got distracted because, you know, when you start down the road of it and you just want to keep going with it instead of actually getting away from the music and thinking through it. And in rehearsal, sometimes it's the same way because you kind of just want to sing it. And but you really have to break it down and make sure it's accurate and get it right and make sure the notes are all right and the rhythms are right and all this kind of stuff. But it's just it wants to sing all of the time. It's like a creature. So it's incredibly exciting. And their role, which I didn't answer, they're the citizens of Catfish Row. And so it's a very basic life. Gershwin did his best to describe what he saw as a child of life in Charleston and how African Americans lived there then. So it's a... You know, there's a strange kind of lack of rule of law, but there's an incredible camaraderie and family spirit. Death is very much a part of their lives, as is love, and it's all incredibly visceral.
And it's very much – I mean, the piece is very much a story of a community as much as it is about individuals.
Yes, right? Yes. And in fact, you know, it's funny because – it's called Porgy and Bess. It ought to be called Catfish Row or something like that, you know, because it starts out with everybody and it's you get the feeling that it's a kind of a hot summer evening and this the music describes this kind of very almost lazy atmosphere. And then, of course, you have the most famous piece of music Gershwin ever wrote, is Summertime, right off the bat, and which returns a few times later on to return to that kind of laziness to give a little bit of counterpoint to the many times when it gets really, really racked up, you know, and the energy is ratcheted up so strongly. But they're all there together and they all sing. Most people don't realize that. The chorus sings in Summertime. They're a part of that aria. And they have, you know, and they hum underneath it, but the harmonies are beautiful. And then at the very end of the opera, what happens at the end of the opera? The community asks Porgy not to leave, and he makes that – I can give away the end of the opera because it's not tragedy. He makes the decision that he is going to leave, and so they all sing this kind of spiritual, "Oh Lord, I'm on my way," which is really about Porgy going to look for Bess, but it becomes this personal community hymn again, although it's not a hymn. It's really kind of a slow – moving spiritual sound, you know. And it's, again, the community being a very, very huge part of the story.
Well, I want to wish you all the best with every production you're working on this season. Thank you so much.
That's my pleasure. Thanks, Roger.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.